Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Priya Nileshwar from Tulane University.
Good afternoon, everyone. First, I would like to thank President Clinton and his dedicated team for selecting this vibrant city as the venue for the Clinton Global Initiative University inaugural meeting. We've had a wonderful morning of sessions, and I hope you all have enjoyed it as much as I have. My name is Priya Nileshwar, and I'm a first-year student here at Tulane University. My major is Global and Community Health, and I'm a member of the Asian American Student Union and the Pre-Med Society. I also serve on the executive board of the India Association of Tulane. As my commitment to action, I have chosen to provide medical supplies to needy hospitals in India by partnering with the nonprofit organization Doc to Doc and expanding its area of focus to include countries in Asia. This afternoon, I have the honor of introducing to you the president of Tulane University, Dr. Scott Cowan. After the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, President Cowan has shown determination and commitment to Tulane University and the city of New Orleans, and he continues to uphold the long and active Tulane tradition of commitment to solving both local and global problems. Please join me in welcoming President Scott Cowan.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be back with you today after having the honor of welcoming you all to New Orleans and to Tulane University last night. Today I've been asked to say a few words about the recovery of Tulane University and New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and I am delighted to share some thoughts with you. First of all, I should tell you that I actually wear four different hats in New Orleans. My day job is president of Tulane University, and Tulane University is the largest employer in Orleans Parish and one of the largest in the state. As a matter of fact, one of my proudest moments of being president of Tulane University occurred on January 16, 2006, when we reopened the university after 5 months of closure, and within 72 hours of our reopening, the population of the parish went up 20% in 72 hours. The three other hats I wear are my commitment to New Orleans and civic engagement. After the storm, Mayor Nagin asked me to head up the community-wide effort to develop a vision and plan for rebuilding public education K through 12 here in New Orleans. That was an effort that I am engaged in even to this day. The plan we developed, which was finished in February of 06, is being enacted and is the largest experiment in rebuilding a public education system in America. I'm very proud of that particular effort, and I believe it will have benefits for the children of New Orleans and I hope around the country for years to come. People always ask me, by the way, why is education my passion and why did I agree to take this on? I will tell you, as a youngster growing up, I was one of those children that would have been left behind if a few teachers hadn't embraced me, took me under their wing, and helped me to develop into the person I am today. And this is one small way that I can thank those who helped me at a time where nobody else would. But my second reason why this is such a passion for me is that I believe the single root of both failure and ultimately success for all the problems we are dealing with today is because we need to have better education for all people, no matter of their race, their location, or socioeconomic class. And this is certainly true in New Orleans, where before the storm we had the worst school system in America, where in 8 years that I was here before that storm we had 9 different superintendents, and there were lots of children being left behind, and hopefully that will change. The other two roles I play is I'm commissioner of something called the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority. You'll hear about it this morning, but that is the agency that is responsible for for the physical redevelopment of the city in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And the last thing that I do, and one of the things that I enjoy the most, is I'm co-founder of a group called the Florida Lee Ambassadors Program. This is a group of 40 New Orleanians who commit every year to make visits to three or four of the major cities in America to talk to TV stations, radio stations, and newspapers to tell our story about what is happening in New Orleans. Because if we simply leave it up to the newspapers to report accurately, that doesn't happen. If we leave it up to the TV, it doesn't happen. So we ourselves go out and tell our story. Let me remind you, if you've forgotten, what impact Hurricane Katrina had on New Orleans and Tulane as an example of one university. Because of Hurricane Katrina, 1,800 people died. Most of them drowned in flood water or suffocated in their homes. 400,000 jobs were lost. 275,000 homes were destroyed. That's 10 times as many as in any other U.S. natural disaster. 80% of this parish was underwater for an average of 57 days. And by the way, 80% of this parish is the equivalent of 7 times the size of Manhattan. After the storm, they took out 22 million tons of debris from New Orleans. That was 4 times the amount of debris that was taken out of New York after the 9/11 tragedy. So by whatever metric you use, unfortunately, this was the worst natural disaster in the history of the United States. It obviously had its impact on Tulane University. 70% of this campus you are on today was flooded. Our entire downtown campus, which comprises our hospital, School of Medicine, and School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, was flooded. Matter of fact, where you are sitting today, 2.5 years ago, your seats, literally and figuratively, would have been in water. We had 13,000 students that were displaced and 8,000 employees for over 5 months. And Tulane University became the first major research university, not the only one in New Orleans, but the first major research university in the last century to close its doors for an entire semester. And by the way, we wound up losing $650 million because of that storm. Yet here we are 2.5 years later from Katrina, and I can tell you in all honesty, I have never been more optimistic about the future of our university and our city than I am today. Let me give you just a couple examples of that source of optimism when it comes to Tulane University. The storm forced Tulane University to take a very close look at itself. Who we are, what we were, and what we were going to be in the future. As a result of that introspection, we had to make a lot of significant changes in how we go forward as a university. But probably the most important learning we took away from Hurricane Katrina was that we have to increase our level of commitment to the whole notion of civic engagement. And that if we as an institution didn't do that, our city wouldn't recover, and we would not have learned something very important as a result of Hurricane Katrina. We now have a requirement for graduation, public service for our students, a requirement that extends all 4 years while they are here. And that requirement is not to go into the lower ninth ward and to paint a house or build a house, which, by the way, we hope they do. It really is a thoughtful, deliberate plan and set of commitments all 4 years while they are here that have to be approved by the faculty before they can graduate. In essence, we thought differently about what a liberal education is all about and began to realize that civic engagement was as important to the development of the heart and mind of students as taking English or history or science or the arts. And this is, of course, an experiment for us as a major research university, but I'm very pleased that we are doing it. Because of that change and other things that we went through, is the level of student interest in Tulane University is at an all-time high. Matter of fact, before the storm and after the storm, we would typically get 17 or 18,000 applications for 1,400 spots in our entering class. For the fall of 08, we actually went from 17,000 to 34,000 applications and filled the entire class. And filled the entire class by January 1st. Now, it's not the number of applications that impresses us. It's not even the quality, academic quality of the students, which is also at an all-time high. It's what they wrote in their essays that really impressed us. Because the common element among those 34,000 applications was they wanted to provide service to America, and they felt right now New Orleans was the best place to do it. If that doesn't get you inspired about students and young people, nothing ever will. That inspires us. Now let me tell you why I'm so optimistic about the future of New Orleans. Because many of you who are not from this state read about New Orleans, and most of what you read is negative. But I have an opportunity as part of that Florida Lee Ambassadors program to travel the world on behalf of our city. And every audience I ever speak to, I always ask them a question. How many of you have ever been to New Orleans? Inevitably, over 90% of every audience always says they've been to New Orleans. And you say, why is it that you've been to New Orleans? And they will say, it is the most unusual city in the United States. Here's what I'm going to tell you about New Orleans, a test for all of you. Do you know any other city in the United States that can lay claim to its own food, its own music, its own architecture, and its own language? None other than New Orleans. This is a unique, unique city. And there's no way America can be an America without New Orleans. And anyone who doubts that has never been here before. And all those defining characteristics, by the way, are still here in great abundance. I hope you don't experiment with too many of them while you're here, but they are here. I do want you to enjoy the food. I do want you to enjoy the music. I want you to stop then. So I tell people around the country, come to New Orleans, because what you're going to see is all the things that you loved about this city before Katrina itself. But I want to tell you another source of optimism I have about New Orleans. And you won't hear this from probably the politicians, but you'll hear it from me. Before Hurricane Katrina, we knew we had a problem with the levees. By the way, all you had to do was read the New York Times every hurricane season, and there would be a headline would say, is this the year for New Orleans? We knew, by the way, we had a problem with public education. We knew we had a problem with crime. We knew we had a problem with blighted and adjudicated properties and deteriorating neighborhoods. We knew we had a problem with health care. We knew in this city we had all those problems. And like so many cities in America, we knew it, but we just couldn't make the changes necessary to improve it. And you know what, my friends? We're now improving every one of those dimensions about this city. We will come out of this with a better public education system. We will come out of this with a better health care system. We will come out of this with better neighborhoods than we ever had before. We will come out of this with a sense of a future that we never had before Hurricane Katrina itself. That is my source of optimism about New Orleans. And no one should doubt our resolve. I would say this as I conclude. There's one other source of optimism I have about New Orleans, and a source of optimism I have about the world. If you look at what's going on in New Orleans, it's a perfect example of democracy in action, where people didn't wait for the government to do the job. People did it themselves every single day. And when you look at New Orleans, it's individual citizens and collections of citizens that are rebuilding this city in a new image. That is one of the most inspiring things I've ever been part of and witnessed in my life. And one of the reasons that we are so proud to host this event is you are all doing this individually and collectively for the globe. So if you wonder, does Scott Cowan feel equally optimistic about the future of the world, I would say absolutely, because look what we have here. We have the future of the world, and with the capabilities you have, anything is possible. CGIU is just a very important initiative to take us to the next level of engagement as universities, as colleges, and as students. And behind every great idea, there's a champion, there's a visionary. We're very fortunate to have visionary, one of the most outstanding human beings in American history, and it's my great pleasure to introduce to all of you President Bill Clinton.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. First, I want to thank President Scott Cowan of Tulane for his speech. It's great. I particularly appreciate the case he made for why this is a unique city that all Americans should want to preserve and bring back. However, he whispered to me that he wanted some credit for not inviting the students to go to Bourbon Street. And I thought that he spoke in sufficient code that he deserves no credit. You got it anyway. Let me say to all of you, we just had a remarkable lunch with the university and college presidents who are here from around America and around the world, talking about what the leadership of the colleges and universities can do to help the students who are here to accelerate the impact of citizen service in general and the specific topics to be discussed here today. I say that to invite all the students to, in the process of this whole endeavor today, tonight, tomorrow morning, if you're staying for the service effort, be sure in your feedback to us, if you have some ideas on the subject that we just discussed at lunch, what can the organized educational institutions do to help empower you more, support you more, and do more to accelerate this? Be sure to give us your ideas on that. Now, I want to hurry into the plenary session because we're dealing with something that is of great importance to me and that I and other members of my family have spent a lot of energy on the last 4 years, which is what do we still have to do in New Orleans to bring it back? In the Gulf area in general, and who's supposed to do it, and what is the role of citizen service there. But I want to begin, as we always do, with recognizing some new commitments. The first goes to Dr. Cowan and the people of Tulane. They are agreeing to do something that I think is quite important, and that is to establish neighborhood-based health centers in communities around New Orleans. This will expand access to high-quality, culturally sensitive, and cost-effective health care, regardless of whether or not the people can afford to have health insurance. Over the course of the next several years, the School of Medicine at Tulane is committed to working with at least two communities to help build and manage health centers, to employ 5 to 8 primary care physicians, to serve up to 20,000 patients a year, with an impact reaching more than 60,000 people. The school will work with partners within the university and citywide to ensure continued development and long-term sustainability of community-based care. I do want to say just a word about this. The health of Louisiana residents has been ranked relative to other states fairly low for the last couple of decades, partly because of the low per capita income in this state, partly because of the problems in the health care system. A lot of you know that I've devoted a lot of my time and life to health care, and there's a lot of discussion, I thank God for, in this election about how the United States can expand access to health care coverage. But it's very important that all of you who care about this understand that even if you cover everyone in the United States with affordable health insurance, which would be a godsend and would help us to slow down the explosive cost for those of you who actually have health care, it still wouldn't necessarily guarantee better health care to the poorest Americans unless we change and augment the health care delivery system. That is what Tulane is proposing to do. And recognizing that after Katrina, now, you just know, Katrina simply threw into high relief a problem which exists here but exists in almost every other economically distressed area of America, which is that there are delivery system issues apart from cost and coverage in most urban areas and most underserved rural areas. And therefore, I urge all of you to look at this endeavor which is now being undertaken here, because it will have relevance far beyond the Katrina-affected areas in the United States. There are, just remember the data, in New York City, where my office is in Harlem, there are delivery system issues that go beyond cost and coverage. So this is really important because of its potential impact, as well as for the actual good that will be done. Thank you very much. Thank you. Let's give him another hand. He was great today. Now, I want to invite three students from Loyola University here in New Orleans, Elliot Sanchez, Nicole Cohn, and Aaron Kirsch, to come up. And while they are coming, I will tell you why they are coming. They have made a commitment to establish a student-sponsored microfinancing fund at Loyola University to provide New Orleans residents with loans to purchase income-producing assets, such as painting supplies. The fund will provide at least 30 loans of $100 or more over the next 18 months. The Student Government Association already has committed $3,000 a year to fund the program, and the project will also benefit students by giving them the opportunity to get practical experience in finance and marketing while confirming Loyola's commitment to social justice. Even before Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans ranked second among large cities in America for its concentration of poverty. By giving residents small loans to rebuild their assets, this commitment can go a long way to alleviating poverty in New Orleans. Let me say a little bit by way of background. I think I may have mentioned this morning, but when Hillary and I started worrying about these microfinance issues 25 years ago, and we met Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Prize-winning founder of the Grameen Bank, in 1983. There was, at the time, only one facility in America, the Shore Bank in Chicago, making microcredit loans to people who otherwise would not have had access to credit. There is a big need for this now, especially because it's not even economical, given the transactional cost for banks to make some of the loans that this fund is going to make. So even if, in theory, these people could qualify for loans, and many of them could, it's not economical. That's why Hillary and I started the first rural microcredit bank in America in the next year in Arkansas. That's why you have Grameen itself moving to New York and opening up offices and beginning to interview potential clients and train people. I think you're going to see a spread of microcredit across America. But I think that what these young people are doing is potentially very important, not only because there are plenty of people in New Orleans who can generate more wealth and income if they have a very modest amount of credit that is repayable at anything approaching an affordable rate, but also because this is not a problem confined to New Orleans. It is more pronounced here because you have more people dislocated and a higher percentage of people without access to traditional credit sources. But what they are doing here has potential positive application throughout the United States, wherever there are people who have good ideas and low incomes and limited access to credit. So I think we should give Elliot, Nicole, and Aaron a big hand. Thank you.
Make sure we came up front.
That's great.
Thank you so much.
Great. This is great. Thank you. Now, our third commitment is Anna Monhatova, a PhD candidate at Peyton Institute at Tulane. Would you come up? Her commitment is to introduce New Orleans public school children to quality after-school activities that combine instruction in tennis, academic support, citizenship, and life skills to improve both their scholastic and physical development as well as their characters. The nonprofit organization A's and Aces will host summer camps and after-school clinics to give tennis instruction to 1,000 second to sixth grade graders to spark their interest in playing tennis throughout education. In high school, A's and Aces will assist promising student athletes in both educational and athletic development, paving a path to college. This program aims to improve community and race relations by giving a diverse group of young people the opportunity to build relationships through common interests and teamwork. After Anna graduates from her program, her PhD program at Peyton Institute at Tulane, she plans to give her full-time attention to developing A's and Aces. There aren't many people who get a PhD and spend their gifts doing this with it, not to make herself wealthier are more famous, but to empower other people to have a more decent life. And I just want to say there are lots of studies. I've been involved in these kind of programs all around the world. We used soccer, for example, in Africa heavily to bring in young people to get them to agree to be tested for HIV and AIDS in a lot of the high infection rate countries where we work. We do a lot of work with our economic and educational empowerment programs in South Africa using sports to do this. So I know that the studies that show young people who play sports tend to get better grades, have better social skills, and are more likely to lead healthy lifestyles are not missed. They are true, and they are true across the world. What is commonly accepted in other places is now being, in effect, reintroduced into life here thanks to this initiative. We also know something that's very important to me, as a father and a spouse, that girls who play sports have better self-esteem, better body image, are less likely to become pregnant as teens, more likely to graduate from high school and college than those who do not. They're more likely to be self-defining in a very positive way in our culture as well as in others across the world. So this is potentially an affair not just of the heart, but of the mind that may be of, again, lasting import, not only to the young women and young boys here who get involved in this kind of work, but also to people throughout our country. So let's give Anna Monhatova a big hand. Thank you. And she's come here to live with us from the Czech Republic, so we should welcome her, too, for that. Okay, now I would like to ask Lori Gonzalez, Catherine Reeves, and Kavinda Udagama, an undergraduate, all undergraduates at Lafayette, to come up here. They have a project, the purpose of which is to help residents of the Lower Ninth Ward rebuild as a model community focusing on green living. Students from Lafayette will assist in these efforts by fostering collaboration, entrepreneurship, and business development. This commitment involves a partnership between the Students Economic Empowerment and Global Learning Project and the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association to rebrand the Lower Ninth Ward as a green urban economy, integrating environmentally friendly businesses practices into all aspects of the community. Led by a faculty mentor, the students from the East Coast, from Lafayette, have established a peer relationship with fellow students at Tulane to bridge a dialogue and inform action. The students will spend their summer assessing the community's pressing needs and make several visits over the coming academic year to implement their projects. The Holy Cross neighborhood is taking the lead in sustainable restoration practices for the rest of the Lower Ninth, the city of New Orleans, and other damaged communities along the Gulf. I particularly appreciate this because ever since I began working here, and I'll say more about this in a minute, with the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund and later with our own climate change initiative, it has been obvious that we had to have local buy-in to make New Orleans a green city, but that if we did it right, it would be less expensive for low-income working people to come home and to live here, more rewarding, and it would be a lot easier to generate more investment as well as more new residents. Getting that buy-in requires the kind of interpersonal relationships that these young people are committed to making happen. So they've come here for a good ways away, and they've made a commitment to the future of New Orleans in a way that I think we can all appreciate. So let's give a big hand to Lori, Catherine, and Kavinda. Thank you. So now let's start the next part of our session. This is a special plenary session involving people who are now or have been heavily involved in rebuilding a sustainable New Orleans. It will examine the current rebuilding efforts, including eco-friendly development, community integration, and provide, I hope, all of you with some more ideas and tools to contribute in the future if you like. First, I think Dr. Cowan is participating. You already know who he is. Second, I want to ask Dr. Ed Blakely, the Executive Director of the Office of Recovery and Development Administration for the City of New Orleans, to come out here. He is a remarkable man. He has 160 people with which he guides the city's recovery effort. He is a genuine scholar and practitioner in the fields of planning and local economic development. He's been a policy advisor to the mayor of Oakland and to the Los Angeles Public School District. He helped to lead the response to the Oakland earthquake in 1988, the fire in 1991, the largest urban fire in the 20th century. He worked with us very closely after the Northridge earthquake in Southern California. Then he moved to New York just before the attacks at Ground Zero. He is always there where needed, and he has performed heroically everywhere he's been. So we thank him for what he's done. Thank you. For all of the terrible things that happened in Katrina, one of the blessings that came to me out of it was meeting the commander of Joint Task Force Katrina, now retired, just retired, Lieutenant General Russell L. Honore, a native of Lakeland, Louisiana, who has been amazing. He led the Department of Defense responses to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. He's had a variety of command and staff positions focused on defense support to civil authorities and homeland defense. He supported the Department of Defense planning and responses for Hurricane Floyd, Lily, Isidore, Isabel, Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Gene. In other words, he's been around the disaster block. He also planned the U.S. military response to the devastating flooding in Venezuela in 1999 and Mozambique in 2000 when I was president. He led the department's planning and preparation for the anticipated Y2K millennium anomaly, the disaster that did not happen, and planned the military response to the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy and the D.C. sniper shootings, disasters that did. He recently retired from the U.S. Army after 37 years of service. And I can tell you, when I came down here and we were all still up to our ears in uncertainty and frustration, this man was an unbelievable model of calm and strength and common sense and determination to get the show on the road. And so I welcome him. Thank you, James. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to ask now Bethany Houseman, the City of Your Louisiana Program Manager, to come out. She is the whole school, whole child program manager for City of Your Louisiana, New Orleans. I told you we started this after Katrina, the city year program here. She supervises teams of 17 to 24-year-olds, dedicating 10 months each to work in the school systems as tutors, mentors, and positive role models. She has been involved in service learning at St. John's University in Queens, New York. She's initiated service learning programs in Africa, Latin America, and Europe. And she has spent the 6 years before this earning a BA and an MA from St. John's. So she's been involved in this work since her freshman year, and we are very grateful to her for the dramatic commitment she has made to help us with service learning and to help us with City Year in New Orleans. So let's give her a big hand here. Stephanie Hoffman. Now, I'd like to ask one of the world's most famous and most important architects, designers, the winner of 3 U.S. Presidential Awards, the Award for Sustainable Development when I was president in 1996, Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Award, and the National Design Award, Mr. Bill McDonough, William McDonough, to come out here. Time magazine twice recognized him as a hero for the planet in 1999 and 2009, stating that, quote, his utopianism is grounded in a unified philosophy that in demonstrable and practical ways is changing the design of the world. Bill McDonough has been determined to see that we do everything we can to rebuild New Orleans on the principles of sustainable development and to try to make it a great green city for the world, which, as I've already said to you more times than you want to hear again, I think is an economic as well as an environmental necessity if we're ever going to get everybody back in this city and have them be able to afford to live here and then model the kind of future we want for our kids. I'd also like to thank, again, the mayor for, along with Dr. Blakely, for allowing us to work here with our climate change initiative. Gene Engel, who was the Assistant Secretary of HUD when I was president, is the city director here in New Orleans for what we're doing on climate change. There are 86 public schools, to give you an idea of where we're going, to give you just so you have a feel for what can still be done here. There are 86 public schools in New Orleans which still require renovation and rebuilding to serve the needs of current residents and those who can't return. We're working with the city to assure that all renovated, newly built schools have, at a very minimum, a 30% increase in mandated energy efficiency. We're also testing a rapid response model to rehabilitate homes, make them more energy efficient, allow residents to return them following a disaster, beginning with the homes of the elderly, the disabled, and very low-income people first. We learned this in Houston. If we could do this and prove that the lowest-income people could save real money on lower electric bills, we would create a radically increased and intensified, almost radicalized environmental constituency for what we wanted to do. Our goal is to have over 100 rehabilitated and more energy efficient houses and a set of learning to share with other communities affected by disasters set up by the end of this year. I want to thank the Green Building Council, the Department of Energy, Global Green, and our local partners, the Recovery School District and the Orleans Parish School District, who have worked with us on the green schools we've built. And thank you, Gene Engel and Martha Jane Murray, for being here in New Orleans. But anyway, that's the 2 cents my foundation's in. So we see the good work these people are doing, and I just thought it would be helpful to all of you as you think about what we're going to do in the future, to get a sense from them about where we are, where we need to go, and what, if anything, young people in America and not just in New Orleans, but all around the world can do to help them finish this critically important job. So let's give them all a big hand and we'll start. First, I want to ask Dr. Blakey a simple question. Where are we? What are the biggest problems? And what are we doing about it? What can the rest of us do to help you move the ball faster?
Well, where we are now is we've just begun the process, really, of rebuilding the city. Those of you who've been in the city know we announced nearly 100 projects in the last couple of weeks to rebuild the city. All of our civic infrastructure is being rebuilt right now. But we had a hard place to start from. We had to start from evacuation the entire city, 80% of the city damaged, and to dewater it, to reorganize it. But the damage didn't just start with the water. The water left a lot of traces here. We have contaminated soil. We have contaminated buildings. So redoing this city is taking an awful lot of work. It's not just doing a building, but it's decontaminating the building. It's decontaminating the soil. It's reusing and recycling things. This is a laboratory not just on rebuilding, but on social change as well. We want to build a better, smarter city, but a socially more equitable. We want to utilize this rebuilding process to rebuild the fabric of the city and to create a new industry here in New Orleans so we are the master builders of sustainable development. That's going to be our major export here. How we rebuild the city with Bill and other people's help is going to make a big difference for the world, but it'll be the new job builder in this city.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask each of our participants a question and then come back and let them all answer some common questions that I think apply to all of you. Maybe I should have called on General Honoré first, but we drove around this city and we reinvented the wheel two or three times in dealing with the frustrations everybody felt in the aftermath. But, General, you know, we brought all these college students here because they want to serve, and a lot of them want to help rebuild New Orleans. But you are in the business of keeping bad things from happening or at least minimizing their impact. And I think it might be helpful if you just say a few words to them about what, if anything, college and university students could do to minimize the impact of natural disasters where they go to college or where they live. Because I can tell you, anybody who really lives here would have given all the world to be dealing with a problem that's about 10% the size that this is. So I think it'd be worth having just somebody with credibility talk a little bit about, do you think, is there a role for volunteerism in the college and university area before something bad happens?
Well, thank you, sir, and I commend all of you for spending your Saturday afternoon worried about the welfare of others. Because if you're here, you're going to be okay. You're here because you're worried about other people. I'm a graduate of the Louisiana school system, which means a lot to me and the folks that I represent from about 125 miles north of here. But the difference that you can make, fellow Americans and folks from around the world, is that we live in a new normal where disasters can happen, whether they're man-made, in terms of terrorist attack, industrial accident, earthquakes, hurricanes, and tornadoes, as we saw last night in Atlanta, one of the most progressive cities in the world, two coliseums full of people going to a basketball game, all the technology in the world, and the people knew there was a tornado happening when the roof started falling in. So what happened in New Orleans can happen in many other cities around America, particularly the mega cities we live in, when we have large concentration of people living in a small concentrated area. The difference you can make is to help rebuild a culture of preparedness in America. You start by building it in your home. You have it in your dorm room. You worry about the people, your neighbors, and those on your street. And you help good government pass good policy. There's no reason why any drugstore in America does not have a generator. What's the importance of a generator? Because if you lose power, people can't get medicines. So people that could walk or drive out of the city, now you have to take them out in ambulances. There's no reason why every gas station don't have a generator. That's policy. But where you can make a difference, I bet you're a graduate student. The question is, once you graduate, what's going to happen if you get out on I-10 and there's an accident And there's a man with his hand cut off in this accident, and baby boy with foot cut off, and the wife is unconscious. What would you do? You answer the question, sir. Yeah. What would you do? 911. 7 years of college. $30,000 of somebody's money. I want to empower you as college students to learn first aid. And I want these college presidents to give you college credit as an elective for you to learn first aid. So you have a practical experience to be involved in one of the most ultimate human experiences, that's to save somebody else's life. And I want you to learn how to do it. And we're going to get it started. We're not going to do it with a policy from Washington. We're going to do it like guerrilla warfare. We're going to put it on the internet. You're going to start reading about it in 30 days. And college presidents are going to get excited about it. And you'll start be able to take classes this fall in learning first aid and disaster assistance. That's what we're going to do, America. We're going to act locally. God bless you.
See what I mean? So, let me ask Bethany Houseman some questions here about the schools. Different set of questions. Aftermath, where was it? The schools had problems before, and you heard Scott Cowan say he thought the schools were getting better, and that was one of the consequences of Katrina. Number one, do you agree with that, Bethany? And number two, what do you think the greatest needs of the school system are? Do we need more? Tell them what your AmeriCorps people, your city, your people are doing. But do you agree that it's getting better? And what do you think the biggest needs are? And a significant number of the schools reopened in New Orleans are charter schools. Charter schools are public schools funded by taxpayer dollars, but they operate sufficiently independent of the central school district that they have more leeway for innovation. And, you know, their opponents say they're more leeway for lack of accountability. But there's, you know, you can argue this flat around. I've been a big proponent of them over many years. But and there was only one in America when I became president. There were over 2,000 when I left, and we helped to fund a lot of them. So I like it, but I would like to get from your perspective at the grassroots level, where are we with the schools, what are your people doing, and what do you think we ought to do?
Well, where are we with the schools is a huge question. We are getting better. The schools are back. The teachers are back. The students are back. And then the question is, where are we going to go from there? So what we talked about before was just all the negativity you hear in the media. Even pre-Katrina, public education was not good. There was nothing but corruption. Right now, 85% of the children in RSD are two grade levels behind. We have the RSD, which is the Recovery School District. They came in and took over because the state said that public schools were just not handling the situation well. We are failing LEAP scores. We are the worst parish. We have the lowest LEAP scores. So my opinion is that there is nowhere else to go but up. We are gonna go up. We have, what we do with City Years, we have tutors and mentors, and we run after school programs, and we hang out with these kids all day, every day. What is really interesting about the public education system in New Orleans is just the microscopic level that people look at it. They look at this 85% of children who are two grade levels behind and can't read, and they look at the crime that they're walking out on every day, and then we look at them and look at them as kids. These are children that we're talking about, and these are kids that are taking these tests, so they're not just numbers. You know, it's becoming real now. Like, we talk to you, we talk to this generation, like, you are the future. Well, let's really, really think about it and think about that future, too. It doesn't just stop with y'all. It keeps going. So these kids are products of the New Orleans public school systems, and they will be proudly when they graduate, and I and my teams will make sure of that, and City Year will make sure of that. The Recovery School District will make sure of that. But also just everything that you can do with your degree. You are in college for a reason. You are in college to serve. You're here to get your experience. And what I can tell you is that you need to get that experience. You need to get that degree in education. You need to go get that degree, become a doctor, but you need that experience. And if you really want to get it, and if you really want to test your education, I dare you to go hang out with these kids. Because you're going to learn a lot. And if you really want to be a teacher, and if you really want to counsel some kids, this is where you got to do it. So I would suggest it highly.
The City Year volunteers, they work in schools that are both charter schools and those that aren't, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you think there's a demonstrable difference in student achievement based on whether they're charter schools or not?
There is statistically, but I don't think that there needs to be. I think that if there is more parental awareness and more parental involvement, the parents don't necessarily have all the information and the resources that they need to know about charters. Charters are brand new to New Orleans. So they're brand new to parents and they're brand new to communities. They don't really know what they are. When I came here, I wasn't really sure what a charter was. I had to look it up. I had to talk to a lot of people who were involved in it. So you have families that are coming back and they're sending their children back to the schools that they went pre-Katrina. When they have a wonderful charter two blocks over with, you know, great accountability and great results, and they just don't know. So it's really about more charters coming, more RSD schools coming, getting a lot of resources, and definitely parental awareness of where they can send their kids.
Thank you. Bill McDonough, I introduced with all of his accolades earlier, so I will say that he's trying to have sustainable development and environmental responsibility at the core of rebuilding here. And he's been involved with Brad Pitt's project and others. He's been just great. But I want him to talk a little bit about, number one, why should we rebuild it all in the Lower Ninth Ward? Number two, if it costs more to do it right in the beginning, even though we can operate these homes more cheaply, how should we finance the difference?
Well, first of all, Brad and I, when we started the Make It Right project, thought very hard and deeply about the idea of building in harm's way to begin with. And our conclusion was simply that to not rebuild would in a way, dishonor those people that were wanting to return home, and would be cynical to not accept the fact that people wanted to come home. And so our decision was to how to bring people home out of harm's way. And so the houses that we're looking to help with will all be lifted off the ground, will all have safety and security and first aid circumstances anticipated and built into the buildings so that they're responsible responses to that question. That's the first thing. As far as the financing and the sustainability overlays, we're looking at a fundamental making of a building when we look at the houses for Make It Right through what we call cradle-to-cradle lenses, where we're looking at the very making of the products themselves, and we're asking the manufacturers, do you have known carcinogens, do you have known mutagens, teratogens, so on. So we're looking deeply at the chemistry of the making of things. As far as the energy is concerned, we're looking at how to make the carbon footprint as small as possible, or perhaps even make it so that the buildings can produce more energy than they need to operate. We're looking through these kinds of lenses at the projects, and the cost will be borne simply by, in our first instance, by the fundraising process that we've set up. We're looking at each family and saying if according to HUD guidelines, a family should spend about a third of their income on a home, on their housing, we're going to be facilitating all the money they need beyond that third of their income through low-interest loans that allow them to vest and get back into their homes with dignity?
Well, first of all, you should applaud that. That's a big deal.
Let me say, when it comes to me, you're preaching to saved. I agree with this, but I'd like to highlight something he just said. In a climate like this, it is actually possible to use environmentally responsible materials, that is, those that were produced well, to create not just energy-efficient homes, but carbon-neutral homes, that is, those that have no real carbon footprint because they produce as much energy from clean energy sources like the sun and the wind as they consume. And these carbon-neutral buildings are being built all over the world now. I was in a real estate developer in Rotterdam, who's one of my partners in not only climate change, but a lot of the healthcare work I do, built his headquarters to be a carbon-neutral building. There's a lot of people who are really visionary business people have figured out that this is the only thing that makes sense. If you go back to what General Honoré said about what happened in the two Coliseums where the basketball games were going on last night and how we're all vulnerable, we'll leave to the side the fact that we will all become more vulnerable to kind of any kind of international organized violence because of open borders. There is no question that even if we all started tomorrow and cut our greenhouse gas emissions to zero, it is going to take a significant amount of time to have this, the world do what has to be done to avert the worst potential calamities of climate change. During that time, there will inevitably be an increase in unpredictable and severe weather events throughout the seasons, but particularly now as we're about to struggle into the springtime. So that's why what General Honoré said is so important. So I just raise that. I think it's very important that we, those of us who can, supplement the fundraising efforts of this, and that we encourage foundations to do this, and that we, as soon as we can, make sure the tax code subsidizes this kind of energy future more than a traditional energy future. If we spend anything remotely approaching the subsidies we spent on yesterday's energy economy, if we spent that on tomorrow's energy economy, you wouldn't have people saying it's uneconomical to build these green houses and clean energy sources. Go ahead.
I've just come back from Abu Dhabi, where they've decided to spend billions of dollars on renewable power in the deserts of the Middle East. And I went there with John Brown, the former head of BP, and he pointed out that globally there are $213 billion of global subsidies available to the oil industries and $13 billion for everything else.
Yeah, anybody tells you we've over-subsidized wind and solar, not paying attention. I mean, go ahead.
In New Orleans, we want to have greenhouses, but it doesn't do good to have a greenhouse if you get out in a gas-guzzling car to move. We are fortunate in having one of the best-planned cities in America here, but we got to connect it. That means bus systems, trolley systems, and the like. Have to be the backbone of this city. Now, those of you who live in New Orleans, you can come any Saturday with me and ride a bike. Because I ride around the city, not just for exercise, but to show people that that's going to be a form of transportation for us. And if people in Holland, where my wife's from, where they close the streets for bicycles and pedestrians, we can do that here. Not only can we must. Because if we don't do it, we're just making bad choices after making a good choice. A good home without a good transportation system is a bad choice. Finally, I want to say we got to eat right, so we got to produce food here. Currently, most of our food comes anywhere from 500 to 1,000 miles. Just for the transport, we've guzzled up an awful lot of energy. But what's worse than that, the food isn't nearly as good because a lot of the nutrients are lost. So we are going to start producing food in the Ninth Ward. We're going to start producing the things we need to survive here. And by the way, General, when I was in school, shows you how old I am, first aid and learn how to swim were required to graduate.
Well, this is very good. Let me say that, my senator has sponsored a lot of efforts in New York to get people actually sponsored in the Congress to promote a different sort of agricultural support system instead of just spending all these subsidies on big corporate farms to help family farms to produce food closer to where it is consumed and then work out the distribution and production network. So what he said to you is absolutely true. This is not just an energy issue. It's a nutrition issue and an economic structure issue. We'd have a lot more family farmers all over America if you could sell the food closer to where it's grown and you had the way of distributing. This is a huge deal, so I thank you. And it would really work big time here in New Orleans and in the American South. But if I could go back to one thing Mr. McDonough said about solar power, how much money we're spending subsidizing various kind of energy. Look, the Energy Department of the United States has a study today that says that there's enough wind that blows from west and north Texas all the way north to the Canadian border with North Dakota to electrify America. Don't you let anybody tell you, all of you who are younger here, don't let all these people say, well, I'd love to do more of this, but it's just not practical. You look at the real numbers. Now, we can't do it for a simple reason. We don't have the transmission lines. But there are several bills in the Congress, including one that she offered, that Hillary offered, that would help to... Wait. No, this is serious. That would help to move the transmission networks from where they now are, near the coal-fired power plant or whatever, closer to where the wind blows and can be generated. This is a huge deal. It's a big problem all over America. I'll give you another example. You could close every urban landfill in the United States and take all the organic material out of the landfill and generate electricity with it. And the problem is that the places that are already built and cheapest to burn that stuff are not by transmission lines. So this is a big issue in New Hampshire, for example, where we've got a lot of closed power plants. But in all these places, we can do this. So I just want you to, when you think about New Orleans and its rebuilding, it is possible not only to have efficient transportation, but you could literally make this city self-sufficient between energy efficiency and available access to wind and sun and geothermal and biomass energy. That's the landfill. And you just think what a wonderful, how much better it'd be in every, particularly poor communities in America, if we could functionally close all our urban landfills and just basically compact the metal stuff and generate clean electricity with the rest. I mean, none of this is new technology, by the way. You just have to move the transmission capacity around. So I just want to say, as you all go back home and you look at your own campuses and your own communities and you think about this, don't let somebody be dismissive of your desire for a clean energy future by telling you, well, this is all very nice, but you can only do 3 or 4% of capacity. It is factually untrue. So get the facts and go after it.
Yeah. By the way, we live near a little river here called the Mississippi. We don't have to
turbines.
We don't have to dam it to produce turbines. Electricity. Put turbines in the Mississippi to produce enough electricity for most of America.
We have the Mississippi flows. You can actually do two turbine. We have a small turbine electric generator in the East River in New York City. And the best places on earth to do it, if you could figure out how to, again, move the transmission to the power source, are in the Indian Ocean between India and right shortly off the coast of India, facing Perth, Australia.
and in Hawaii, where they could really, you know, use the self-sufficiency. But these things are out there, and we really need to be alive to these possibilities. And our goal ought to be clean energy independence and agricultural independence and sustainable agriculture, like you guys were talking about, at the grassroots level wherever we can. It's much better for the economy, and it is also necessary. If you really care about global warming, it's necessary because we will never be able to persuade the Chinese, the Indians, the Indonesians, the Vietnamese, the Mexicans, the Brazilians. Let's just go down the line of every country with over 50 million people with an emerging economy. They're perfectly capable of burning the planet up and compromising your future without any help from America, Europe, or Japan. But once the Middle East decides that they can make more money out of clean energy than oil, which they can over the long run, and matter of fact, they can make money out of both of them, then you're going to, they're building 7 green cities in Saudi Arabia at a massive cost. So this, the world is going in a certain way, but we have to prove that it is economically sustainable to do it in order to get other countries to join us. And why shouldn't New Orleans be Exhibit A? Why shouldn't we help them and do this? So,
I would just, sir, if I could actually add to that, I would just like to say in the one of the schools that we serve in, they actually have the edible schoolyard program, where children are taught how to grow, how to compost, how to recycle, how to cook their own food for their families. They can even bring it home and do it at home. And also Louisiana farmers are brought in to teach them about the career of farming and the actuality of farming. So, you know, when we're talking about the second generation and we're talking about education, it's not even going to be a question of them that it's not reality. It's going to be second nature if we have more programs like this for the young.
If I may, to follow up. We had to do a significant cultural shift. In the 1960s, we were worried about mutual destruction between us and the Soviet Union. And the nation kept 3 years of food stored. And folks came along and said, why are we spending $10 million a year storing butter? The reason we were storing butter was in the event the Soviets popped a nuke in California or Wisconsin and the cows became radiated, we'd have food. We took what was in the 60s, survival of America, and it got replaced with a culture of nothing but economics. And it became cheaper, better, quicker. So we stopped storing food, depending on a food chain. Just-in-time food. And we globalized much of our production. I'm telling you, America, we need to focus on the survival of America again and recreate a culture of preparedness. Because you, in your current education, you're not being prepared for survival. Survival from a perspective, if we have a pandemic, or think about what happens in New Orleans today if you lose power for 15 days. Most of you would have to leave the city. It happened when I was born. The day I was born, a storm hit. But it wasn't a problem for us. I had 3 light bulbs in the house. We got up the next morning after the storm, my parents did, and food was running around in the yard. You don't have that luxury. You don't have that luxury. If you lose power and the store is not open, you're in a heap of trouble. We need to think about survival from a different perspective and recreate our culture of preparedness, that you not only can do first aid, you know how to use chlorine to help purify water. And we need to think bigger. You need to cast the net out. The little problems we're talking about here are logistics. You need to build airplanes that can sniff out a pandemic that's on the way to America. You need to build buildings that are smart that can tell something's been released in the air. Don't worry, these little logistics problems are problems old dudes like me created. We could fix with money. You could fix this by eliminating poverty. The way you eliminate poverty is get kids education. The way you eliminate poverty... is to create more businesses. And when you make environment a business, not a social
because it will be fixed. And when you make preparation a business, it will get fixed. We fixed the AIDS problem with business coming up with medicines and schools teaching kids about AIDS and TV programs. We did a cultural shift. We'll have to do a cultural shift for the survival of America, but also for the survival of the world. We've got to change how we're doing business, and we've got to create opportunities to grow locally, live locally, and to have a sustainable economy that can work inside disasters and inside influences from around the world. So I thank you again for the opportunity to speak to that topic.
Thank you. I want to ask, thank you. I want to ask Ed and Bill one more question. I want to ask, how are we doing on this? On this whole idea of a greener and more sustainable rebuilding. My little Bush Clinton Katrina Fund, we gave you some money for a couple of schools, but is there a movement here to really genuinely raise the standards and change the mentality, and how are we doing on it? I wanted to ask you that, and I wanted to ask you afterward, how are we doing on the real money for the real houses you and Brad want to do, and what else can all of us do to make sure we get this show on the road? Once you get enough of these model things up and people see they work, it spreads like wildfire. You know, we won't have any sale to make once you get to show people what it really does. So could we start?
I want to be honest with you. The rush to rebuild sometimes leads to the simple, quick solutions rather than the best solution. And so that's a real tension that we have going on here. And thanks to Bill and others, and thanks to the initiative you've created, my staff is working very hard to bring sustainable development to every project. And we've convinced FEMA that every project is going to be built in a green way. But this morning, I was dealing with emails from people who want me to put back big malls, who feel that that's what urban America is all about. And I have to work with retailers and so forth, asking them, if you drive around the city, you're going to see those Walgreens stores looking different. You're going to see the parking lots in different places. But that is a fight, because your parents want to park in the front. Your parents want the big mall with 8 acres of parking, and they think that's what urban America is about. You got to re-educate yourselves. You got to start walking. You got to start doing the things. You got to start businesses that are more friendly, that provide food locally. You got to work with one another. If it requires a chain, make a change that's small, chain that's small and local, not a chain that's big and guzzles. That's up to you. You're the next generation. You are the new entrepreneurs. And if you want wall whatever to run your lives, you won't have me leading you.
Well, for Make It Right, we have we've been in a fundraising mode. We'll continue to be in a fundraising mode because Our basic strategy is to offer this approach to as many people as possible, which means we've opened ourselves to the possibility of going beyond the first goal, which is 150 houses, to as many houses as we can afford to do. The way we're financing it with these low-interest loans and no-interest loans will allow people to get back in their homes and have a long and decent life there. The idea is that if somebody flips the home relatively quickly, we get our money back and can turn it right back into the next project. So the idea is it's a recurring fund, and we're working on going from $15 to $20 million with a goal of $30 million. And the money's coming from large donors, and Brad himself has made a major personal commitment. A lot of small donations. We're also looking at the building industries of the United States for their support. And we've received quite a bit, and we'll continue to receive that. We're looking at some major donations from the chemical industry. But we're asking the chemical industry, can you make cradle-to-cradle products for us to put in the homes? So we're going to be looking at the products not just as donations, but as nutrients for urban renewal. So it's an ongoing process, and there's a lot for everyone to do contributing. You can go to our website, little ad, make it right, NOLA.org, and it'll show you how to get involved.
Thank you. So let's give them all a hand. Now, we just say, now you know, if you individually or your group or your school, if you want to get involved with the city's overall effort, you know where to start. If you want to help create a culture of preparedness, including where you live, you know where to go. If you want to support the revitalization of education in one of the most important sites in America, you've got a contact. And if you want to build tomorrow's housing today, you should support Make It Right. And you should know that all these things, they reach a critical mass. I just want to try to tie all this together as we close here. You heard General Honore mention that we need a culture of preparedness because we're vulnerable. That's because we live in an interdependent world. You can't claim the benefits of the interdependent world that most of you do a bazillion times a day without even thinking about it. Every time you get on a BlackBerry or talk to somebody on the Internet or look at something on YouTube or MySpace or, you know, whatever. We're a part of this. But we also are more vulnerable to each other. We're vulnerable to the instability of climate change and more crazy weather permits. And we're vulnerable to the insecurity of exposure to terror, weapons of mass destruction, and global epidemics like avian influenza. The third big challenge of the modern world is this persistent inequality, because the rewards to education and the rewards to prior access to capital are so great that there tends to be an increasing inequality, almost with more prosperity, both in poor countries and in rich countries. So you look at America now, for example, we have in this decade 90% of the income gains of growth went to the top 10% of earners, 43% of that to the top 1%, a big part of that to the top 0.1%. That's another thing you get if you change the agricultural production patterns. But the point is, that's the world you're living in. Now, has anybody escaped this trap in a rich country? Yep. Denmark, Sweden, with way high taxes, and the United Kingdom had lots of new jobs in this decade and no increase in inequality. Do these three countries have anything in common? Yeah. They are three of only six out of 170 signatories to the Kyoto Protocol that are going to not only meet, but beat their Kyoto targets, and they have generated so much new employment and so many new kinds of at-hand, like the agriculture sustainable development opportunities, that they have created both new jobs and rising incomes and a stronger middle class and declining poverty. There are no other examples I can find in any of the wealthy countries on earth that have escaped the inequality trap in this decade. Now, you think about that. So when you think about whether you want to support what they're trying to do down there with the housing or this, the overall approach to rebuilding, or whether we should have green schools and educate kids in the environment simultaneously, or going to all this sort of prevention work, you just keep in mind what I just think. Take Denmark. I'll close with Denmark because it's the simplest. Right? They grow their economy 50% in this decade with zero increase in electricity. Zero. 100% through efficiency. And they reduce their greenhouse gas emissions while growing 50% by generating, now they're probably just slightly over 25% of electricity from wind. And you can say, oh, there's 5 million of them, the wind blows, it's easier for them. Yeah, it is. We have to think. So we'd have to redo the transmission lines in the Texas Panhandle. Wouldn't you rather do that than burn the planet up for your kids? I mean, come on. Why are we making this like this is such a big deal? This is a... So, I mean, you want Abu Dhabi to beat you to solar energy? It's less embarrassing than having Germany do it, which is what has already happened. I mean, Germany has 80 million people. We have 300 million. The sun shines more here than it does there. They generate more solar energy than we do. Why? Because they're subsidizing tomorrow's economy instead of yesterday's. These are all decisions you have to make. And the same thing can be true in every developing country in the world. This is not just a rich country phenomenon. This is a new and a radically different way of living available to people all over the earth. It's the only way to escape the inequality trap of our interdependence. So I just would plead with you, to those of you who care, stay involved in New Orleans. Keep supporting this. Those of you who want to take off from what all these distinguished people have said, access it. But don't pretend you can walk away from it. This is the question which will most likely have the biggest impact and shape on the shape of the future that you hope to have, whether you live in a rich country or a poor country, here, the Middle East, Asia, Europe, or Latin America. This is it. So New Orleans is basically taking a step into the future that you all have to follow. Thank you, and God bless you.